called the cab. Ted took Bobby over to the bar and ordered them both root beers. He doesn't know I don't really like root beer, Bobby thought. It seemed another piece in the puzzle somehow, the puzzle of Ted. Len served them himself, saying nothing about how Bobby shouldn't be sitting at the bar. He was a nice kid, but just stinking the place up with his under-21-ness. Apparently a free phone call wasn't all you got when you bet $500 on a prize fight. And not even the excitement of the bet could long distract Bobby from a certain dull certainty which stole much of his pleasure in hearing that his father hadn't been such a bad guy after all. The bet had been made to earn some run-out money. Ted was leaving. The taxi was a checker with a huge back seat. The driver was deeply involved in the Yankees game on the radio to the point where he sometimes talked back to the announcer. Files and his sister knew your father, didn't they? It wasn't really a question. Yeah, Elena especially. She thought he was a real nice guy. Bobby paused. But that's not what my mother thinks. I imagine your mother saw a side of him. Elena Files never did, Ted replied. More than one. People are like diamonds in that way, Bobby. They have many sides. But Mom said... It was too complicated. She never exactly said anything, really. Only sort of suggested stuff. He didn't know how to tell Ted that his mother had sides, too. And some of them made it hard to believe those things she never quite came out and said. And when you got right down to it, how much did he really want to know? His father was dead, after all. His mother wasn't, and he had to live with her. And he had to love her. He had no one else to love, not even Ted, because... When you going? Bobby asked in a low voice. After your mother gets back, Ted sighed, glanced out the window, then looked down at his hands, which were folded on one crossed knee. He didn't look at Bobby, not yet. Probably Friday morning. I can't collect my money until tomorrow night. I got 4-1 on Albini. That's 2 grand. My good pal Lenny will have to phone New York to make the cover. They crossed a canal bridge. And down there was back there. Now, they were in the part of the city Bobby had traveled with his mother. The men on the streets wore coats and ties. The women wore hose instead of Bobby socks. None of them looked like Elena Files, and Bobby didn't think many of them would smell of liquor if they went shh, either. Not at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I know why you didn't bet on Patterson Johansson, Bobby said. It's because you don't know who'll win. I think Patterson will this time, Ted said, because this time he's prepared for Johansson. I might flutter $2 on Floyd Patterson, but 500, to bet 500, you must either know or be crazy. The Albini-Haywood fight is fixed, isn't it? Ted nodded. I knew when you read that Kleindienst was involved, and I guessed that Albini was supposed to win. You've made other bets on boxing matches where Mr. Kleindienst was a manager. Ted said nothing for a moment, only looked out the window. On the radio, someone hit a comebacker to Whitey Ford. Ford fielded the ball and threw to Moose Scourin at first. Now there were 2 down in the top of the 8th. At last, Ted said, it could have been Haywood. It wasn't likely, but it could have been. Then, did you see the old man back there, the one in the shoeshine chair? Sure, you patted him on the cheeks. That's Arthur Girardi. Files lets him hang around because he used to be connected. That's what Files thinks, used to be. Now he's just some old fellow who comes in to get his shoes shined at 10 and then forgets and comes in to get them shined again at 3. Files thinks he's just an old fellow who don't know from nothing, as they say. Girardi lets him think whatever he wants to think. If Files said that the moon was green cheese, Girardi wouldn't say boo. Old G, he comes in for the air conditioning, and he's still connected. Connected to Jimmy G? To all sorts of guys. Mr. Files didn't know the fight was fixed? No, not for sure. I thought he would. But old G knew, and he knew which one's supposed to take the dive. Yes, that was my luck. Hurricane Haywood goes down in the 8th round. Then, next year, when the odds are better, the hurricane gets his payday. Would you have bet if Mr. Girardi hadn't been there?
Nope,
Ted replied immediately. Then what would you have done for money when you go away? Ted looked depressed at those words, when you go away. He made as if to put an arm around Bobby's shoulders, then stopped himself. There's always someone who knows something, he said. They were on Asher Avenue now, still in Bridgeport, but only a mile or so from the Harwich town line. Knowing what would happen, Bobby reached for Ted's big nicotine-stained hand. Ted swiveled his knees toward the door, taking his hands with him. Better not. Bobby didn't need to ask why. People put up signs that said, "Wet paint, do not touch," because if you put your hand on something newly painted, the stuff would get on your skin. You could wash it off, or it would wear off by itself in time. But for a while, it would be there. Where will you go?
I don't know.
I feel bad, Bobby said. He could feel tears prickling at the corners of his eyes. If something happens to you, it's my fault. I saw things, the things you told me to look out for, but I didn't say anything. I didn't want you to go, so I told myself you were crazy, not about everything, just about the low men you thought were chasing you, and I didn't say anything. You gave me a job, and I muffed it. Ted's arm rose again. He lowered it, and settled for giving Bobby a quick pat on the leg instead. At Yankee Stadium, Tony Kubek had just doubled home 2 runs. The crowd was going wild.
But I knew, Ted said mildly.
Bobby stared at him. What? I don't get you.
I felt them getting closer. That's why my trances have grown so frequent. Yet I lied to myself, just as you did. For the same reasons, too. Do you think I want to leave you now, Bobby, when your mother is so confused and unhappy? In all honesty, I don't care so much for her sake. We don't get along. From the first second we laid eyes on each other, we didn't get along. But she is your mother, and...
What's wrong with her? Bobby asked. He remembered to keep his voice low, but he took Ted's arm and shook it. Tell me. You know. I know you do. Is it Mr. Biderman? Is it something about Mr. Biderman? Ted looked out the window, brow furrowed, lips drawn down tightly. At last he sighed, pulled out his cigarettes, and lit one.
Bobby, he said, Mr. Biderman is not a nice man. Your mother knows it, but she also knows that sometimes we have to go along with people who are not nice. Go along to get along, she thinks. And she has done this. She's done things over the last year that she's not proud of, but she has been careful. In some ways, she has needed to be as careful as I have, and whether I like her or not, I admire her for that.
What did she do? What did he make her do? Something cold moved in Bobby's chest. Why did Mr. Biderman take her to Providence?
For the real estate conference.
Is that all? Is that all?
I don't know. She didn't know.
Well, perhaps she has covered over what she knows and what she fears with what she hopes. I can't say.
Sometimes I can. Sometimes I know things very directly and clearly. The first moment I saw you, I knew that you wanted a bicycle, that getting one was very important to you, and you meant to earn the money for one this summer if you could. I admired your determination.
You touched me on purpose, didn't you?
Yes, indeed. The first time, anyway, I did it to know you a little. But friends don't spy. True friendship is about privacy, too. Besides, when I touch, I pass on a kind of, well, a kind of window. I think you know that. The second time I touched you, really touching, holding on, you know what I mean? That was a mistake. But not such an awful one. For a little while, you knew more than you should, but it wore off, didn't it? If I'd gone on, though, touching and touching the way people do when they're close, there'd come a point where things would change. Where it wouldn't wear off. He raised his mostly smoked cigarette and looked at it distastefully. The way you smoke one too many of these and you're hooked for life. Is my mother all right now? Bobby asked, knowing that Ted couldn't tell him that. Ted's gift, whatever it was, didn't stretch that far.
I don't know.
Ted suddenly stiffened. He was looking out the window at something up ahead. He smashed his cigarette into the armrest ashtray, doing it hard enough to send sparks scattering across the back of his hand. He didn't seem to feel them. Christ, he said. Oh, Christ, Bobby, we're in for it. Bobby leaned across his lap to look out the window, thinking in the back of his mind about what Ted had just been saying, touching and touching the way people do when they're close, even as he peered up Asher Avenue. Ahead was a three-way intersection, Asher Avenue, Bridgeport Avenue, and the Connecticut Pike, all coming together at a place known as Puritan Square. Trolley tracks gleamed in the afternoon sun. Delivery trucks honked impatiently as they waited their turns to dart through the crush. A sweating policeman with a whistle in his mouth and white gloves on his hands was directing traffic. Off to the left was the William Penn Grill, a famous restaurant which was supposed to have the best steaks in Connecticut. Mr. Biderman had taken the whole office staff there after the agency sold the Waverly estate, and Bobby's mom had come home with about a dozen William Penn Grill books of matches. Its main claim to fame, his mom had once told Bobby, was that the bar was over the Harwich town line, but the restaurant proper was in Bridgeport. Parked in front, on the very edge of Puritan Square, was a DeSoto automobile of a purple Bobby had never seen before, had never even suspected. The color was so bright it hurt his eyes to look at it. It hurt his whole head. Their cars will be like their yellow coats and sharp shoes and the greasy perfume stuff they use to slick back their hair, loud and vulgar. The purple car was loaded with swoops and darts of chrome. It had fender skirts. The hood ornament was huge. Chief DeSoto's head glittered in the hazy light like a fake jewel. The tires were fat white walls and the hubcaps were spinners. There was a whip antenna on the back. From its tip there hung a raccoon tail. The low men, Bobby whispered. There was really no question. It was a DeSoto, but at the same time it was like no car he had ever seen in his life. Something as alien as an asteroid. As they drew closer to the clogged three-way intersection, Bobby saw the upholstery was a metallic dragonfly green. The color nearly howled in contrast to the car's purple skin. There was white fur around the steering wheel. Holy crow! It's them.
You have to take your mind away, Ted said. He grabbed Bobby by the shoulders. Up front, the Yankees blared on and on, the driver paying his two fares in the back seat no attention whatsoever, thank God for that much at least, and shook him once hard before letting him go. You have to take your mind away, do you understand?
He did. George Sanders had built a brick wall behind which to hide his thoughts and plans from the children. Bobby had used Maury Wills once before, but he didn't think baseball was going to cut it this time. What would? Bobby could see the Asher Empire's marquee jutting out over the sidewalk three or four blocks beyond Puritan Square, and suddenly he could hear the sound of Sully John's bolo bouncer, whap, whap, whap. If she's trash, S.J. had said, I'd love to be the trash man. The poster they'd seen that day filled Bobby's mind. Brigitte Bardot, the French sex kitten, was what the papers called her, dressed only in a towel and a smile. She looked a little like the woman getting out of the car in one of the calendars back at the corner pocket, the one with most of her skirt in her lap and her garters showing. Brigitte Bardot was prettier, though. And she was real. She was too old for the likes of Bobby Garfield, of course. I'm so young and you're so old, Paul Anka singing from 1,000 transistor radios. This, my darling, I've been told, but she was still beautiful. And a cat could look at a queen. His mother always said that, too. A cat could look at a queen. Bobby saw her more and more clearly as he settled back against the seat.
his eyes taking on that drifty, far-off look Ted's eyes got when he had one of his blankouts. Bobby saw her shower-damp puff of blonde hair, the slope of her breasts into the towel, her long thighs, her painted toenails standing over the words adults only must have driver's license or birth certificate. He could smell her soap, something light and flowery. He could smell Nuit en Paris, her perfume, and he could hear her radio in the next room. It was Freddie Cannon, that bebop summertime avatar of Savin Rock. She's dancing to the drag, the cha-cha ragamop. She's stomping to the shag, rocks the bunny hop. He was aware, faintly, far away, in another world, farther up along the swirls of the spinning top, that the cab in which they were riding had come to a stop right next to the William Penn Grill, right next to that purple bruise of a DeSoto. Bobby could almost hear the car in his head. If it had had a voice, it would have screamed, "Shoot me, I'm too purple, shoot me, I'm too purple," and not far beyond it he could sense them. They were in the restaurant, having an early steak. Both of them ate it the same way, bloody rare. Before they left, they might put up a lost pet poster in the telephone lounge or a hand-printed car for sale by owner card upside down, of course. They were in there. Low men in yellow coats and white shoes drinking martinis between bites of nearly raw steer. And if they turned their minds out this way, steam was drifting out of the shower. Bibi raised herself on her bare painted toes and opened her towel, turning it into brief wings before letting it fall. And Bobby saw it wasn't Brigitte Bardot at all. It was Carol Gerber. "You'd have to be brave to let people look at you with nothing on but a towel," she had said, and now she had let even the towel fall away. He was seeing her as she would look 8 or 10 years from now. Bobby looked at her, helpless to look away, helpless in love, lost in the smells of her soap and her perfume, the sound of her radio. Freddie Cannon had given way to the platters. Heavenly shades of night are falling. The sight of her small painted toenails. His heart spun as a top did, with its lines rising and disappearing into other worlds than this. The taxi began creeping forward. The four-door purple horror parked next to the restaurant, parked in a loading zone, Bobby saw, but what did they care? Began to slide to the rear. The cab jolted to a stop again, and the driver cursed mildly as a trolley rushed clang-a-lang through Puritan Square. The low DeSoto was behind them now, but reflections from its chrome filled the cab with erratic, dancing minnows of light. And suddenly Bobby felt a savage itching attack the backs of his eyeballs. This was followed by a fall of twisting black threads across his field of vision. He was able to hold on to Carol, but he now seemed to be looking at her through a field of interference. "They sense us, or they sense something. Please, God, get us out of here. Please get us out!" The cabbie saw a hole in the traffic and squirted through it. A moment later, they were rolling up Asher Avenue at a good pace. That itching sensation behind Bobby's eyes began to recede. The black threads across his field of interior vision cleared away, and when they did, he saw that the naked girl wasn't Carol at all, not anymore at least. Not even Brigitte Bardot, but only the calendar girl from the corner pocket, stripped mother naked by Bobby's imagination. The music from her radio was gone. The smells of soap and perfume were gone. The life had gone out of her. She was just she's just a picture painted on a brick wall, Bobby said. He sat up. "Say what, kid?" the driver asked and snapped off the radio. The game was over. Mel Allen was selling cigarettes. "Nothing," Bobby said. "Guess you's dozed off, huh? Slow traffic, hot day. That'll do it every time, just like Hadlow says. Looks like your pal's still out." "No," Ted said, straightening. "The doctor is in." He stretched his back and winced when it crackled. "I did doze a little, though." He glanced out the back window, but the William Penn Grill was out of sight now. "The Yankees won, I suppose."
"Goddamn engines, they ruined them,"
the cabbie said and laughed.
"Don't see how yous could sleep with the Yankees playing."
They turned onto Broad Street. 2 minutes later, the cab pulled up in front of 149. Bobby looked at it as if expecting to see a different color paint or perhaps an added wing. He felt he'd been gone 10 years. In a way, he supposed he had been. Hadn't he seen Carol Gerber all grown up? I'm going to marry her, Bobby decided as he got out of the cab. Over on Colony Street, Mrs. O'Hara's dog barked on and on, as if denying this and all human aspirations.
Roof, 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 roof.
Ted bent down to the driver's side window with his wallet in his hand. He plucked out 2 singles, considered, then added a third. Keep the change.
You're a gent,
the cabbie said. He's a shooter, Bobby corrected, and grinned as the cab pulled away.
Let's get inside, Ted said. It's not safe for me to be out here.
They went up the porch steps, and Bobby used his key to open the door to the foyer. He kept thinking about that weird itching behind his eyes and the black threads. The threads had been particularly horrible, as if he'd been on the verge of going blind. Did they see us, Ted, or sense us, or whatever they do?
You know they did, but I don't think they knew how close we were.
As they went into the Garfield apartment, Ted took off his sunglasses and tucked them into his shirt pocket.
You must have covered up well.
Ooh, hot in here. What makes you think they didn't know we were close? Ted paused in the act of opening a window, giving Bobby a level look back over his shoulder.
If they'd known, that purple car would have been right behind us when we pulled up here.
It wasn't a car, Bobby said, beginning to open windows himself. It didn't help much, the air that came in, lifting the curtains in listless little flaps, felt almost as hot as the air which had been trapped inside the apartment all day. I don't know what it was, but it only looked like a car, and what I felt of them. Even in the heat, Bobby shivered. Ted got his fan, crossed to the window by Liz's shelf of knick-knacks and set it on the sill. They camouflage themselves as best they can, but we still feel them. Even people who don't know what they are often feel them. A little of what's under the camouflage seeps through, and what's underneath is ugly. I hope you never know how ugly. Bobby hoped so, too. Where do they come from, Ted?
A dark place.
Ted knelt, plugged in his fan, flipped it on. The air it pulled into the room was a little cooler, but not so cool as the corner pocket had been, or the Criterion. Is it in another world? Like in Ring Around the Sun? It is, isn't it? Ted was still on his knees by the electrical plug. He looked as if he were praying. To Bobby, he also looked exhausted, done almost to death. How could he run from the low men? He didn't look as if he could make it as far as Spicer's Variety Store without stumbling. Yes, he said at last, they come from another world.
Another where and another when. That's all I can tell you. It's not safe for you to know more.
But Bobby had to ask one other question. Did you come from one of those other worlds?
Ted looked at him solemnly. I came from Teaneck.
Bobby gaped at him for a moment, then began to laugh. Ted, still kneeling by the fan, joined him. What did you think of in the cab, Bobby? Ted asked, when they were finally able to stop. Where did you go when the trouble started? He paused. What did you see? Bobby thought of Carol at 20 with her toenails painted pink. Carol standing naked with a towel at her feet and steam rising around her.
Adults only. Must have driver's license. No exceptions.
I can't tell, he said at last, because... Well...
Because some things are private. I understand.
Ted got to his feet. Bobby stepped forward to help him, but Ted waved him away.
Perhaps you'd like to go out and play for a little while, he said. Later on, around 6, shall we say, I'll put on my dark glasses again and we'll go around the block, have a bite of dinner at the Colony Diner.
But no beans.
The corners of Ted's mouth twitched in the ghost of a smile. Absolutely no beans. Beans? Verboten. At 10 o'clock, I'll call my friend Len and see how the fight went, eh? The low men. Will they be looking for me now, too? I'd never let you step out the door if I thought that, Ted replied, looking surprised. You're fine. And I'm going to make sure you stay fine. Go on now. Play some catch or ring Olivio or whatever it is you like. I have some things to do. Only be back by 6, so I don't worry. Okay. Bobby went into his room and dumped the 4 quarters he'd taken to Bridgeport back into the bike fund jar. He looked around his room, seeing things with new eyes, the cowboy bedspread, the picture of his mother on one wall and the signed photo, obtained by saving cereal box stops, of Clayton Moore in his mask on another. His roller skates, one with a broken strap in the corner. His desk against the wall. The room looked smaller now. Not so much a place to come to, as a place to leave. He realized he was growing into his orange library card, and some bitter voice inside cried out against it. Cried, no, no, no. Bobby makes a confession. The Gerber baby and the Maltex baby. Rhonda. Ted makes a call. Cry of the hunters. In Commonwealth Park, the little kids were playing tiki ball. Field B was empty. On Field C, a few teenagers in orange St. Gabriel's t-shirts were playing scrub. Carol Gerber was sitting on a bench with her jump rope in her lap watching them. She saw Bobby coming and began to smile. Then the smile went away. Bobby, what's wrong with you? Bobby hadn't been precisely aware that anything was wrong with him until Carol said that, but the look of concern on her face brought everything home and undid him. It was the reality of the low men and the fright of the close call they'd had on their way back from Bridgeport. It was his concern over his mother. Mostly, it was Ted. He knew perfectly well why Ted had shooed him out of the house and what Ted was doing right now, filling his little suitcases in those carry-handle paper bags. His friend was going away. Bobby began to cry. He didn't want to go all ushy-gushy in front of a girl, particularly this girl, but he couldn't help it. Carol looked stunned for a moment, scared. Then she got off the bench, came to him, and put her arms around him. That's all right, she said. That's all right, Bobby. Don't cry. Everything's all right. Almost blinded by tears and crying harder than ever, it was as if there were a violent summer storm going on in his head. Bobby let her lead him into a copse of trees where they would be hidden from the baseball fields and the main paths. She sat down on the grass, still holding him, brushing one hand through the sweaty bristles of his crew cut. For a little while she said nothing at all, and Bobby was incapable of speaking. He could only sob until his throat ached and his eyeballs throbbed in their sockets. At last the intervals between sobs became longer. He sat up and wiped his face with his arm, horrified and ashamed of what he felt, not just tears but snot and spit as well. He must have covered her with mung. Carol didn't seem to care. She touched his wet face. Bobby pulled back from her fingers, uttering another sob, and looked down at the grass. His eyesight, freshly washed by his tears, seemed almost preternaturally keen. He could see every blade and dandelion. "It's all right," she said. But Bobby was still too ashamed to look at her. They sat quietly for a little while, and then Carol said, "Bobby, I'll be your girlfriend if you want."
You are my girlfriend, Bobby said. Then tell me what's wrong. And Bobby heard himself telling her everything, starting with the day Ted had moved in and how his mother had taken an instant dislike to him. He told her about the first of Ted's blankouts, about the low men, about the signs of the low men. When he got to that part, Carol touched him on the arm. What, he asked, you don't believe me? His throat still had that achy, too-full feeling it got after a crying fit, but he was getting better. If she didn't believe him, he wouldn't be mad at her, wouldn't blame her a bit. In fact, it was just an enormous relief to get it off his chest. That's okay, I know how crazy it must. I've seen those funny hopscotches all over town, she said. So has Yvonne and Angie. We talked about them. They have little stars and moons drawn next to them, sometimes comets, too. He gaped at her. Are you kidding? No. Girls always look at hopscotches. I don't know why. Close your mouth before a bug flies in. He closed his mouth. Carol nodded, satisfied, then took his hand in hers and laced her fingers through his. Bobby was amazed at what a perfect fit all those fingers made. Now tell me the rest. He did, finishing with the amazing day he'd just put in, the movie The Trip to the Corner Pocket, how Alana had recognized his father in him, the close call on the way home. He tried to explain how the purple DeSoto hadn't seemed like a real car at all, that it only looked like a car. The closest he could come was to say it had felt alive somehow, like an evil version of the ostrich Dr. Doolittle sometimes wrote in that series of talking animal books they'd all gone crazy for in the second grade. The only thing Bobby didn't confess was where he'd hidden his thoughts when the cab passed the William Penn Grill and the backs of his eyes began to itch. He struggled, then blurted the worst as a coda. He was afraid that his mother going to Providence with Mr. Biderman and those other men had been a mistake. A bad mistake. Do you think Mr. Biderman's sweet on her? Carol asked. By then they were walking back to the bench where she had left her jump rope. Bobby picked it up and handed it to her. They began walking out of the park and toward Broad Street. Yeah, maybe, Bobby said glumly. Or at least. And here was part of what he was afraid of. Although it had no name or real shape, it was like something ominous covered with a piece of canvas. At least she thinks he is. Is he going to ask her to marry him? If he did, he'd be your stepdad. God! Bobby hadn't considered the idea of having Don Biderman as a stepfather, and he wished with all his might that Carol hadn't brought such a thing up. It was an awful thought. If she loves him, you just better get used to the idea, Carol spoke in an older woman, worldly wise fashion that Bobby could have done without. He guessed she had already spent too much time this summer watching the old John O'Marsha shows on TV with her mom. And in a weird way, he wouldn't have cared if his mom loved Mr. Biderman, and that was all. It would be wretched, certainly, because Mr. Biderman was a creep. But it would have been understandable. More was going on, though. His mother's miserliness about money or cheapskatiness was a part of it, and so was whatever had made her start smoking again and caused her to cry in the night sometimes. The difference between his mother's Randall Garfield, the untrustworthy man who left the unpaid bills, and Alana's Randy Garfield, the nice guy who liked the jukebox turned up loud, even that might be a part of it. Had there really been unpaid bills? Had there really been a lapsed insurance policy? Why would his mother lie about such things? This was stuff he couldn't talk about to Carol. It wasn't reticence. It was that he didn't know how. They started up the hill. Bobby took one end of her rope, and they walked side by side, dragging it between them on the sidewalk. Suddenly, Bobby stopped and pointed. Look. There was a yellow length of kite tail hanging from one of the electrical wires crossing the street farther up. It dangled in a curve that looked sort of like a question mark. Yeah, I see it, Carol said, sounding subdued. They began to walk again. He should go today, Bobby. He can't. The fight's tonight if Albini wins. Ted's got to get his dough at the billiard parlor tomorrow night. I think he needs it pretty bad. Sure he does, Carol said. You only have to look at his clothes to see he's almost broke.
What he bet was probably the last money he had. His clothes, that's something only a girl would notice, Bobby thought, and opened his mouth to tell her so. Before he could, someone behind them said, "Oh, look at this. It's the Gerber baby and the Maltex baby. How you doing, babies?" They looked around. Biking slowly up the hill toward them were three St. Gabe's boys in orange shirts. Piled in their bike baskets was an assortment of baseball gear. One of the boys, a pimply galoot with a silver cross dangling from his neck on a chain, had a baseball bat in a homemade sling on his back. Thinks he's Robin Hood, Bobby thought, but he was scared. They were big boys, high school boys, parochial school boys, and if they decided they wanted to put him in the hospital, then to the hospital he would go. Low boys in orange shirts, he thought. "Hi, Willie," Carol said to one of them, not the galoot with the bat slung on his back. She sounded calm, even cheery, but Bobby could hear fright fluttering underneath like a bird's wing. "I watched you play. You made a good catch." The one she spoke to had an ugly, half-formed face below a mass of combed-back auburn hair and above a man's body. The huffy bike beneath him was ridiculously small. Bobby thought he looked like a troll in a fairy tale. "What's it to you, Gerber baby?" he asked. The three St. Gabe's boys pulled up even with them, then two of them, the one with the dangling cross and the one Carol had called Willie, came a little farther, standing around the forks of their bikes, now walking them. With mounting dismay, Bobby realized he and Carol had been surrounded. He could smell a mixture of sweat and Vitalis coming from the boys in the orange shirts.
"Who are you, Maltex baby?"
the third St. Gabe's boy asked Bobby. He leaned over the handlebars of his bike for a better look.
"Are you Garfield?" "You are, ain't you? Billy Donahue's still looking for you from that time last winter. He wants to knock your teeth out. Maybe I ought to knock one or two of them out right here, give him a head start."
Bobby felt a wretched crawling sensation begin in his stomach, something like snakes in a basket. "I won't cry again," he told himself. "Whatever happens, I won't cry again, even if they send me to the hospital, and I'll try to protect her." Protect her? From big kids like this, it was a joke. "Why are you being so mean, Willie?" Carol asked. She spoke solely to the boy with the auburn hair. "You're not mean when you're by yourself. Why do you have to be mean now?" Willie flushed. That, coupled with his dark red hair, much darker than Bobby's, made him look on fire from the neck up. Bobby guessed he didn't like his friends knowing he could act like a human being when they weren't around.
"Shut up, Gerber baby," he snarled. "Why don't you just shut up and kiss your boyfriend while he's still got all his teeth?"
The third boy was wearing a motorcycle belt cinched on the side and ancient snapjack shoes covered with dirt from the baseball field. He was behind Carol. Now he moved in closer, still walking his bike, and grabbed her ponytail with both hands. He pulled it.
"Ow!"
Carol almost screamed. She sounded surprised as well as hurt. She pulled away so hard that she almost fell down. Bobby caught her, and Willie, who could be nice when he wasn't with his pals, according to Carol, laughed.
"Why'd you do that?"
Bobby yelled at the boy in the motorcycle belt, and as the words came out of his mouth, it was as if he'd heard them 1,000 times before. All of this was like a ritual, the stuff that got said before the real yanks and pushes began and the fists began to fly. He thought of Lord of the Flies again, Ralph, running from Jack and the others. At least on Golding's Island there'd been a jungle. He and Carol had nowhere to run. He says, "Because I felt like it, that's what comes next." But before the boy with the side-cinched belt could say it, Robin Hood, with the homemade bat sling on his back, said it for him.
"Because he felt like it. What you gonna do about it, Maltex baby?"
He suddenly flicked out one hand, snake quick, and slapped Bobby across the face. Willie laughed again. Carol started toward him.
"Willie, please don't."
Robin Hood reached out, grabbed the front of Carol's shirt, and squeezed.
"Got any titties yet?"
"Nah, not much. You ain't nothing but a Gerber baby."
He pushed her. Bobby, his head still ringing from the slap, caught her, and for the second time kept her from falling down. "Let's beat this queer up," the kid on the motorcycle belt said. "I hate his face." They moved in, the wheels of their bikes squeaking solemnly. Then Willie let his drop on his side like a dead pony and reached for Bobby. Bobby raised his fists in a feeble imitation of Floyd Patterson.
"Say, boys, what's going on?"
someone asked from behind them. Willie had drawn one of his own fists back, still holding it cocked.
He looked over his shoulder. So did Robin Hood and the boy with the motorcycle belt. Parked at the curb was an old blue Studebaker with rusty rocker panels and a magnetic Jesus on the dashboard. Standing in front of it, looking extremely busty in the chest and extremely wide in the hip, was Anita Gerber's friend, Rianda. Summer clothes were never going to be her friends, even at 11, Bobby understood this, but at that moment she looked like a goddess in pedal pushers. Rianda! Carol yelled, not crying, but almost. She pushed past Willie and the boy in the motorcycle belt. Neither made any effort to stop her. All three of the St. Gabe's boys were staring at Rianda. Bobby found himself looking at Willie's cocked fist. Sometimes Bobby woke up in the morning with his Peter just as hard as a rock, standing straight up like a moon rocket or something. As he went into the bathroom to pee, it would soften and wilt. Willie's cocked arm was wilting like that now, the fist at the end of it, relaxing back into fingers, and the comparison made Bobby want to smile. He resisted the urge. If they saw him smiling now, they could do nothing. Later, however, on another day... Rianda put her arms around Carol and hugged the girl to her large bosom. She surveyed the boys in the orange shirts, and she was smiling, smiling and making no effort to hide it. Willie Sherman, isn't it? The formerly cocked back arm dropped to Willie's side. Muttering, he bent to pick up his bike. Richie O'Meara? The boy in the motorcycle belt looked at the toes of his dusty snapjacks and also muttered something. His cheeks burned with color. One of the O'Meara boys, anyway, there's so damn many of you now I can't keep track. Her eyes shifted to Robin Hood. And who are you, big boy? Are you a Dedham? You look a little bit like a Dedham. Robin Hood looked at his hands. He wore a class ring on one of his fingers, and now he began to twist it. Rianda still had an arm around Carol's shoulders. Carol had one of her own arms, as far around Rianda's waist as she could manage. She walked with Rianda, not looking at the boys, as Rianda stepped up from the street onto the little strip of grass between the curb and the sidewalk. She was still looking at Robin Hood. You better answer me when I talk to you, son. It won't be hard to find your mother if I want to try. All I have to do is ask Father Fitzgerald. Harry Doolin, that's me, the boy said at last. He was twirling his class ring faster than ever. Well, but I was close, wasn't I? Rianda asked pleasantly, taking another two or three steps forward. They put her on the sidewalk. Carol, afraid to be so close to the boys, tried to hold her back, but Rianda would have none of it. Dedhams and Doolins, all married together, right back to County Cork, tra-la-tra-lee. Not Robin Hood, but a kid named Harry Doolin, with a stupid homemade bat sling strapped to his back. Not Marlon Brando from The Wild One, but a kid named Richie O'Meara, who wouldn't have a Harley to go with his motorcycle belt for another 5 years, if ever, and Willie Shearman, who didn't dare to be nice to a girl when he was with his friends. All it took to shrink them back to their proper size was one overweight woman in pedal pushers and a shell top who had ridden to the rescue not on a white stallion but in a 1954 Studebaker. The thought should have comforted Bobby, but it didn't. He found himself thinking of what William Golding had said, that the boys on the island were rescued by the crew of a battle cruiser, and good for them. But who would rescue the crew? That was stupid. No one ever looked less in need of rescuing than Rianda Hewson did at that moment, but the words still haunted Bobby. What if there were no grown-ups? Suppose the whole idea of grown-ups was an illusion. What if their money was really just playground marbles, their business deals no more than baseball card trades, their wars only games of guns in the park? What if they were all still snotty-nosed kids inside their suits and dresses? Christ, that couldn't be, could it? It was too horrible to think about. Rianda was still looking at the St. Gabe's boys with her hard and rather dangerous smile. You three fellows wouldn't have been picking on kids younger and smaller than yourselves, would you? One of them a girl, like your own little sisters? They were silent, not even muttering now. They only shuffled their feet. I'm sure you weren't, because that would be a cowardly thing to do now, wouldn't it? Again she gave them a chance to reply, and plenty of time to hear their own silence. Willie?
Richie? Harry? You weren't picking on them, were you?
Of course not, Harry said. Bobby thought that if he spun that ring of his much faster, his finger would probably catch fire.
If I thought a thing like that, Rhianda said, still smiling her dangerous smile, I'd have to go talk to Father Fitzgerald, wouldn't I? And the father, he'd probably feel he had to talk to your folks. And your fathers probably feel obliged to warm your asses for you, and you deserve it, boys, wouldn't you, for picking on the weak and small?
Continued silence from the three boys, all now astride their ridiculously undersized bikes again.
Did they pick on you, Bobby?
Rhianda asked.
Nope,
Bobby said at once. Rhianda put a finger under Carol's chin and turned her face up. Did they pick on you, Lovey? No, Rhianda. Rhianda smiled down at her, and although there were tears standing in Carol's eyes, she smiled back.
Well, boys, I guess you're off the hook, Rhianda said. They say you haven't done nothing that'll cause you a single extra uncomfy minute in the confessional. I'd say you owe them a vote of thanks, don't you?
Mutter, mutter, mutter from the St. Gabe's boys. Please let it go at that, Bobby pleaded silently. Don't make them actually thank us. Don't rub their noses in it. Perhaps Rhianda heard his thought. Bobby now had good reason to believe such things were possible.
Well, she said, maybe we can skip that part. Get along home, boys. And Harry, when you see Moira Dedham, tell her Rhianda says she still goes to the Binger over in Bridgeport every week if she ever wants a ride.
Well, sure,
Harry said. He mounted his bike and rode away up the hill, eyes still on the sidewalk. Had there been pedestrians coming the other way, he would likely have run them over. His two friends followed him, standing on their pedals to catch up. Rhianda watched them go, her smile slowly fading. Shanty Irish, she said at last, just trouble waiting to happen.
Bah, good riddance to him.
Carol, are you really all right?
Carol said she really was.
Bobby?
Sure, I'm fine.
It was taking him all the discipline he could manage not to start shaking right in front of her like a bowl of cranberry jelly. But if Carol could keep from falling apart, he guessed he could.
Get in the car, Rhianda said to Carol. I'll give you a lift up to your house. You move along yourself, Bobby. Scoot across the street and go inside. Those boys will have forgotten all about you and my Carol girl by tomorrow, but tonight it might be smart for both of you to stay inside.
Okay, Bobby said, knowing they wouldn't have forgotten by tomorrow, nor by the end of the week, nor by the end of the summer. He and Carol were going to have to watch out for Harry and his friends for a long time.
Bye, Carol.
Bye.
Bobby trotted across Broad Street. On the other side, he stood watching Rhianda's old car go up to the apartment house where the Gerbers lived. When Carol got out, she looked back down the hill and waved. Bobby waved back, then walked up the porch steps of 149 and went inside. Ted was sitting in the living room, smoking a cigarette and reading Life magazine. Anita Ekberg was on the cover. Bobby had no doubt that Ted's suitcases and the paper bags were packed, but there was no sign of them. He must have left them upstairs in his room. Bobby was glad. He didn't want to look at them. It was bad enough just knowing they were there.
What did you do? Ted asked.
Not much, Bobby said. I think I'll lie down on my bed and read until supper.
He went into his room. Stacked on the floor by his bed were three books from the adult section of the Harwich Public Library. Cosmic Engineers by Clifford D. Simak, The Roman Hat Mystery by Ellery Queen, and The Inheritors by William Golding. Bobby chose The Inheritors and lay down with his head at the foot of his bed and his stocking feet on his pillow. There were cave people on the book's cover, but they were drawn in a way that was almost abstract. You'd never see cave people like that on the cover of a kid's book. Having an adult library card was very neat, but somehow not as neat as it had seemed at first. Hawaiian Eye was on at 9 o'clock. And Bobby ordinarily would have been mesmerized. His mother claimed that shows like Hawaiian Eye and The Untouchables were too violent for children and ordinarily would not let him watch them. But tonight his mind kept wandering from the story. Less than 60 miles from here, Eddie Albini and Hurricane Haywood would be mixing it up. The Gillette Blue Blades girl, dressed in a blue bathing suit and blue high heels, would be parading around the ring before the start of every round and holding up a sign with a blue number on it. 1, 2, 3, 4. By 9:30, Bobby couldn't have picked out the private eye on the TV show, let alone guessed who had murdered the blonde socialite.
Hurricane Haywood goes down in the 8th round, Ted had told him. Old Gene knew it, but what if something went wrong? He didn't want Ted to go, but if he had to, Bobby couldn't bear the thought of him going with an empty wallet. Surely that couldn't happen, though, or could it? Bobby had seen a TV show where a fighter was supposed to take a dive and then changed his mind. What if that happened tonight? Taking a dive was bad. It was cheating. No shit, Sherlock. What was your first clue? But if Hurricane Haywood didn't cheat, Ted would be in a lot of trouble.
Hurtin' for certain was how Sully John would have put it. 9:30, according to the sunburst clock in the living room wall. If Bobby's math was right, the crucial 8th round was now underway.
How do you like the inheritors?
Bobby was so deep into his own thoughts that Ted's voice made him jump. On TV, Keenan Wynn was standing in front of a bulldozer and saying he'd walk a mile for a camel. It's a lot harder than Lord of the Flies, he said. It seems like there are these two little families of cave people wandering around, and one family is smarter. But the other family, the dumb family, they're the heroes. I almost gave up, but now it's getting more interesting. I guess I'll stick with it.
The family you meet first, the one with the little girl, they're Neanderthals. The second family, only that one's really a tribe, Golding and his tribes, are Cro-Magnons. The Cro-Magnons are the inheritors. What happens between the two groups satisfies the definition of tragedy. Events tending toward an unhappy outcome, which cannot be avoided. Ted went on, talking about plays by Shakespeare and poems by Poe and novels by a guy named Theodore Dreiser. Ordinarily, Bobby would have been interested. But tonight his mind kept going to Madison Square Garden. He could see the ring, lit as savagely as the few working pool tables in the corner pocket had been. He could hear the crowd screaming as Haywood poured it on, smacking the surprised Eddie Albini with lefts and rights. Haywood wasn't going to tank the fight. Like the boxer in the TV show, he was going to show the other guy a serious world of hurt instead. Bobby could smell sweat and hear the heavy biff, baff of gloves on flesh. Eddie Albini's eyes came up double zeros. His knees buckled. The crowd was on its feet, screaming.
The idea of fate as a force which can't be escaped seems to start with the Greeks. There was a playwright named Euripides who...
Call, Bobby said.
And although he'd never had a cigarette in his life, by 1964 he would be smoking over a carton a week, his voice sounded as harsh as Ted's did late at night after a day's worth of Chesterfields.
Beg your pardon, Bobby.
Call Mr. Files and see about the fight.
Bobby looked at the sunburst clock. 9:49.
If it only went 8, it'll be over now.
I agree that the fight is over. But if I call Files so soon, he may suspect I knew something, Ted said. Not from the radio, either. This one isn't on the radio, as we both know. It's better to wait. Safer. Let him believe I am a man of inspired hunches. I'll call at 10, as if I expected the result to be a decision instead of a knockout. And in the meantime, Bobby, don't worry. I tell you, it's a stroll on the boardwalk.
Bobby gave up trying to follow Hawaiian Eye at all. He just sat on the couch and listened to the actors quack. A man shouted at a fat Hawaiian cop. A woman in a white bathing suit ran into the surf. One car chased another while drums throbbed on the soundtrack. The hands of the sunburst clock crawled, struggling toward the 10 and the 12 like climbers negotiating the last few hundred feet of Mount Everest. The man who'd murdered the socialite was killed himself as he ran around in a pineapple field in Hawaiian Eye. Finally ended. Bobby didn't wait for the previews of next week's show. He snapped off the TV and said, "Call, okay, please call."
"In a moment," Ted said. "I think I went one root beer over my limit. My holding tank seemed to have shrunk with age."
He shuffled into the bathroom. There was an interminable pause, and then the sound of pee splashing into the bowl.
"Ah," Ted said.
There was considerable satisfaction in his voice. Bobby could no longer sit. He got up and began pacing around the living room. He was sure that Tommy Hurricane Haywood was right now being photographed in his corner at the garden, bruised but beaming as the flashbulb splashed white light over his face. The Gillette Blue Blades girl would be there with him, her arm around his shoulders, his hand around her waist, as Eddie Albini slumped forgotten in his own corner, dazed eyes puffed almost shut, still not completely conscious from the pounding he had taken. By the time Ted returned, Bobby was in despair. He knew that Albini had lost the fight and his friend had lost his $500. Would Ted stay when he found out he was broke? He might, but if he did and the low men came... Bobby watched, fists clenching and unclenching as Ted picked up the telephone and dialed.
"Relax, Bobby," Ted told him. "It's going to be okay."
But Bobby couldn't relax. His guts felt full of wires. Ted held the phone to his ear without saying anything for what seemed like forever.
"Why don't they answer?"
Bobby whispered fiercely.
"It's only rung twice, Bobby.
Why don't you...
Hello? This is Mr. Brodigan calling. Ted Brodigan? Yes, ma'am, from this afternoon."
Incredibly, Ted tipped Bobby a wink. How could he be so cool? Bobby didn't think he himself would have been capable of holding the phone up to his ear if he'd been in Ted's position, let alone winking.
"Yes, ma'am, he is."
Ted turned to Bobby and said without covering the mouthpiece of the phone, "Alana wants to know how is your girlfriend?" Bobby tried to speak and could only wheeze.
"Bobby says she's fine," Ted told Alana, "pretty as a summer day. May I speak to Len?" "Yes, I can wait. But please tell me about the fight."
There was a pause, which seemed to go on forever. Ted was expressionless now. And this time, when he turned to Bobby, he covered the mouthpiece.
"She says Albini got knocked around pretty good in the first five, held his own in 6 and 7, then threw a right hook out of nowhere and put Haywood on the canvas in the 8th. Lights out for the Hurricane. What a surprise, huh?"
"Yes," Bobby said. His lips felt numb. It was true, all of it. By this time Friday night, Ted would be gone. With 2,000 rocks in your pocket, you could do a lot of running from a lot of low men. With 2,000 rocks in your pocket, you could ride the big gray dog from sea to shining sea. Bobby went into the bathroom and squirted Ipana on his toothbrush. His terror that Ted had bet on the wrong fighter was gone. But the sadness of approaching loss was still there, and still growing. He never would have guessed that something that hadn't even happened could hurt so much. A week from now, I won't remember what was so neat about him. A year from now, I'll hardly remember him at all.
Was that true? God, was that true?
No, Bobby thought, no way, I won't let it be. In the other room, Ted was conversing with Len Files. It seemed to be a friendly enough palaver, going just as Ted had expected it would. And yes, here was Ted saying he'd just played a hunch. A good, strong one, the kind you had to bet if you wanted to think of yourself as a sport. Sure, 9:30 tomorrow night would be fine for the payout, assuming his friend's mother was back by 8. If she was a little late, Len would seem around 10 or 10:30. Did that suit? More laughter from Ted, so it seemed that it suited fat Lenny Files right down to the ground. Bobby put his toothbrush back in the glass on the shelf below the mirror, then reached into his pants pocket. There was something in there his fingers didn't recognize.